Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to What Culture Gaming. I'm your host, Cy White, joined by Dan Durkin.
Hello.
And joined by Joe Johnston.
Hello.
To talk all things Fallout TV series. We did a video last week breaking down episode one, but now all 8 episodes, we have devoured them all, as you surely have as well. This is the full spoiler cast for series one of the show, and you know what we thought of it, what we liked, didn't like, and where we think it might go in the future. So let's start broad. Dan, I asked you last week, you know, coming in as a big fan, what your expectations were and if it met them. So Joe, in that case, did you have expectations for the show, and how did you feel like, did it match them at all?
Yeah, I knew what I wanted from it, rather than expectations. You know, my expectation, and I think my knowledge coming in, was this is going to be your classic story of a vault dweller leaves the vault and discovers the horrendous world outside, you know, discovers the wasteland. Of course, that was what we got. I also know what I wanted and what I didn't want from it. And the one thing that had, I suppose, worried me a little bit was when I saw the original trailers, it came across like it was maybe going to be very serious. There was some humor in them, but it came across mostly very serious. And knowing Jonathan Nolan, who has written most of Christopher Nolan's films and sort of was the guy behind Westworld, I thought, oh, is this going to go down a slightly po-faced route when Fallout has always been very funny?
Yeah.
In reality. And luckily we got that. The whole show is genuinely funny from start to finish. You know, not quite on the level of being a comedy, but keeps that really like charming humor that Fallout has always had through and through. So I was really pleased with that. And that was just one of the few things about it that I thought was brilliant. One of the many things about it that I thought was brilliant. You know, that's one tiny aspect. Overall, I thought we had a really, really great show, a really brilliant first season. And it kind of gave me everything I wanted from a first season of a Fallout show.
We talked about that when we, as I say, last week, talked about episode one, where you really get that moment in that first episode where all the violence starts. And it's kind of played for laughs, like it's kind of ridiculous. And that was a moment for me where it was like, okay, good. Like, this is video game silly as well.
Yeah.
And it balances all of that nicely. And Dan, you and I were very happy with episode one, a lot of praise on it. Did that sort of continue for you through the rest of the season?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think there was a really consistent bar of quality throughout the whole show, which is very hard to do. But yeah, from the get-go, I really enjoyed it and it just continued. It got better. There was a little bit here and there that I didn't agree with and thought could have been done better, but we'll probably get into that in a bit. But yeah, overall, I really enjoyed it.
It's been called one of the best video game adaptations of all time, obviously, been chucked right up there with The Last of Us. And there's a big discussion to be had there about whether or not video games are better off as TV series rather than film, because back-to-back successes here. And I think they've even cited that The Last of Us was an inspiration for Fallout, which is really good. And I'm with you guys completely. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm not much of a binger of TV series, but I kind of accidentally watched all of this in the space of 2 days. So to have that going for it at the very least. And even as someone who's, I wouldn't say cursory knowledge of Fallout, it's a bit more than that. I know there's plenty of the lore and stuff, but I'm not deep into it. I've always been interested in that world and never necessarily played through a full game. I really, really enjoyed it. And this is kind of what I needed to be like, oh, I can actually get entrenched in this world a little bit more, because I don't necessarily get on with the gameplay of Bethesda games. It's like, finally, I get to enjoy Fallout, and I watched most of it with a Fallout fan sat next to me as well. So they were just like, oh, this is this, by the way. And I'm like, oh, I know that one. And all, you know, that there was lots of, oh, I know that, at the very least.
Yeah.
How do we feel about how it handled, like, references throughout? Do you feel like it was a bit heavy-handed with that kind of thing, or did it feel like it was just... you were in the world, so it made sense for it to be there, which is how I felt. But again, I have an outside perspective on this. So, Joe, did you feel like it was heavy-handed with any references, or was it just about spot on?
No, I think everything was handled very organically, because I've really sort of turned against the, you know, when you get a show or a film that, you know, I mean, the current sort of, the current like Marvel and Lucasfilm properties are such a nightmare for this of, you know, something appears on screen and there's like, there's a pause. Because they're waiting for the audience to applaud, you know, and yeah, and it feels, yeah. And I just hate that so much. But none of this felt like it did that, you know. There were constant sort of visual references to this and that, you know. There's that when you know, Lucy early on, she opens a little box of Yum Yum deviled eggs, and you know, the box of Yum Yum deviled eggs is there on screen for you to see, but it doesn't sort of. It doesn't pause on it hugely. It doesn't point at it and go, look at this thing you can eat in the game, you know, and nothing at any point ever felt like it was like really thrust in your face like that. It was just there in the world, because the world needs to have all that stuff to be the world of Fallout. So it needs to be there on screen, obviously, but not in a way that's trying to kind of get a cheer out of the audience. It's just all there. And they've kind of recreated that world, I'd say, incredibly well.
Dan, same question for you. Was there any references that you particularly liked or any that turned you off?
Yeah, well, I think as a whole, as Joe just mentioned, like everything felt organic. And I think that is the main thing. Just things like hearing the noise of the guns reloading, hearing like the Stimpak noise, like it's just ripped from the game. And I think it fits into the show really, really well. And it's not in your face. And I think that's the most important thing, because they could very well just rely too much on the references, like, oh, it's Nuka-Cola and all that. Like, it's from the game. Like, look at this. But I think, yeah, like Joe said, it was like integrated into the world so organically. It's more believable that way, I think, because the amount of things that are just there in the background, like you see like a super mutant arm in the Enclave thing at the start. You see like bits of like robots and other things just in the background, and you have to be like on the lookout for it as well. Like there's a lot of stuff that is there like front and center, but there's a lot of hidden references, I think, in the background of the scenes too, which you might have to go back and rewatch certain scenes to like pick up on that sort of thing. And I think, yeah, it was really well done.
I think one of the things in terms of recognizable stuff, just very surface level, is the characters they picked as well. Like they picked, no, I don't want to say obvious, that sounds, you know, harsh, but they picked a Vault Dweller, a Ghoul, and someone from the Brotherhood of Steel. It was like, these are the three obvious or character designs to lead the show. And I was kind of intrigued by how they were going to juggle these three characters and what the story was going to be, where they were going to team up and journey together. And it's not that, like, they're all doing the same thing, but they kind of cross paths as they go and weave around, and they all sort of bump into each other in mostly separate ways and that kind of thing. So let's talk about characters.
Yeah.
Joe, any standout characters for you from the main three, or just in general, who did you like?
Speaking of the protagonists, first off, I think they've done a really, really great job with them, because as you kind of, you go through it, they've got these three conflicting personalities kind of really perfect. So if we start with Lucy, she's your classic Vault Dweller and is so incredibly naive. I think they've written her very well. You know, that kind of main overarching bit of personality is kind of naivety. And I think she does even say it at one point. She says, Vault Dwellers, we're naive, and that's a good thing. You know, she constantly believes in kind of doing better and doing right by people. And to kind of boil it down to video game speak, I like that she was, you know, she was like a player character who's trying to kind of roll charisma a lot of the time. You know, she's not like a pure combat build, essentially. So much of what happens with her, she's attempting to get by via sort of de-escalation and conversation and things. I think that's really nice. But what they also did was that early montage of her kind of saying, hey, I'm Lucy, and I'm like, it was applying for a marriage license, essentially, wasn't it? But she says, you know, I'm proficient in target practice and like martial arts and this and this and this, engineering. Yeah. So it was kind of giving her a reason to not be completely useless when she got out into the world. It was like, okay, we've established this kind of fun, quite jokey reason why she's tough, but she's also still completely unprepared for what she sees. And then Maximus, again, naive, but kind of in his own way, having been essentially raised by a sort of pseudo-religious, pseudo-fascist cult of like weird techno-Nazis. When Lucy very matter-of-factly says, hey, do you want to have sex? Which I just thought was brilliant. It's like, why wouldn't you just say that?
Do you think Maximus became a little bit of a caricature of himself? Because at the start, he seemed like quite competent. But then as it went on, I think it was a little bit weird, like his personality shift.
I can see that. But I think it worked quite nicely with them going into Vault 4, not to jump ahead too much, and seeing him kind of embrace like, oh, I'm being looked after. Mm-hmm. And I've got all this nice stuff. And I sort of think if I was that guy, I might do that. You know, like maybe you would kind of try and embrace a slightly more peaceful life. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would say that he becomes a caricature, but maybe on a rewatch, which I will do at some point, maybe I will find that. Do you want to just elaborate a bit more on that before we get to the ghoul?
Yeah, I mean, I can see the perspective on that. I actually quite liked the sort of mirroring of those two characters being naive. Like, Lucy's the sort of true, lawful good, as you'd expect, coming out of a vault, having quite a cushy life and all of this. And then repeatedly throughout the series, over and over and over again, she gets basically, you know, loads of examples of why you should trust absolutely no one. And she gets to the point where it's like, there's genuine help and she's very aware that this could be a trick. And so I quite liked that. And same thing kind of goes for Maximus, but on the other side, like for a lot of the show, I feel like it was you're not sure if you're meant to be able to trust this guy, because there's a lot of questions early on about whether he injured his soldier in arms, mm-hmm, with the boot trick at the beginning with the razor blade in the boot. And that's a question about whether or not he did it until the end of the season. And obviously he watches the real Night Titus die and then he's like, haha, now I get the armor that I've wanted all my life. I quite liked him as this sort of, he's almost like, and Joe, I'm on your side here a little bit, like all the people that are like, oh, the armor's so cool, but just ignore the fact that they're actually kind of a weird bunch of dudes. Because yeah, he's just totally focused on, I want to wear the armor because it will make me heroic. And he will screw over anyone to get to that point, because he's got a certain set of ideals that aren't actually correct. And it's certainly not how other people view, you know, the people in that armor. So I thought that was really interesting to see those character arcs. And on the other side, you mentioned the ghoul. He's the complete reverse of that. Like, he's over it. He's seen it all. One of his first lines when he comes out of the ground on, close to it, is, I'm in this for the love of the game.
Yeah.
He is chaos, which I thought was quite interesting. Dan, what did you make of the ghoul?
Oh, I loved him. I think Cooper was his name, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Do you remember what his surname
Howard.
Was? Cooper Howard.
Yeah. And it turns out at the end, he's still looking for his family. So that raises the question of, well, what's gone on with them? And obviously we're going to go into like season two discussion a little bit like further down the line. But like, he's just a badass gunslinger character that I think this world needs. And even though he's kind of like the bad karma-esque character, like I found myself rooting for him in most of the situations that he was put in. And like the episode when they were at the Super Duper Mart, when he just goes in and gets like, takes all the like chems and stuff. It's just, it was so funny to see.
Fills himself full of chems.
Yeah. I think the juxtaposition with the pre-war stuff as well, like we're seeing him, what he was like before the bombs fell in, like how his perception of Vault-Tec and all that changed because like he was spying on his wife and all that sort of thing. And just seeing this character like become from, he was like this icon with being a movie star. And then now he's just this jaded, like, badass just murderer pretty much.
Well, not just a movie star, but you know, a Western star, a kind of an all-American hero star, you know, so all-American that the vault suits were based off the colors he wore as this character, you know. I really like to just sort of get into the weeds a bit. You know, he goes from, you know, in the present day, or is it the past, or is it the future? Because it's 2077. Who knows? The flashback scenes. You know, his films are very much archetypal kind of American westerns of, mm-hmm. say, the 50s. But the character he resembles 219 years later, as a kind of wandering, amoral drifter, is much closer to your kind of Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
You know, your Sergio Leone spaghetti western character. And at various times, he reminded me of all three of those characters from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, you know, Blondie, Angel Eyes, and Tuco, directly at times. You know, when he's in the in one of the later episodes where he goes to that the lead farmers who were wearing very cool NCR helmets.
Yes, I love that.
Nice detail. When he goes to them, that's very reminiscent of a scene in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly where Angel Eyes has tracked down a family and is questioning them, you know. And certainly earlier on, whenever he turned up on screen, he had a little leitmotif, which you may have noticed, which wasn't quite the full Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But it very much did that. And that is what Eastwood would have behind him every time he turned up on screen in that film. So they know what they're doing there. And I think it's very smart.
I thought his inclusion as sort of being able to be a part of that pre-war story stuff was really good. And I know this is
brilliant.
I was very aware watching it. I was like, this is the kind of stuff that might upset some of fans when it comes to the lore and stuff. Because I know this, even though it's not in the games, obviously, because games take place way later, this stuff's really precious and really important for building that universe. So for him to be inserted into it as a new character and having the background that he does have, which I thought was really good, like, as you say, the American paragon of virtue movie star that does one advert and then it kind of wrecks his career because mm-hmm. of his association with
yeah.
the bombs being dropped and stuff like that, I thought was really interesting. But even there's like his connections closer to Vault-Tec, and there's a lot of discussion about maybe Vault-Tecs are the ones that dropped the bomb that's been inserted. I know that's a point of contention with yeah. some people that watch this. So I guess talking about the pre-war stuff, you know, as you guys as fans, do you feel like it honored that in the right way? Or was there stuff in there where you were like, I kind of wish they hadn't made him, you know, the Vault Boy or whatever?
I didn't mind that. Like, I thought it was good to now have that, where that iconic imagery has come from.
Yeah.
We now know that. And I think, again, like talking about the pre-war stuff, just seeing how the Vault-Tec employees sided with some of the other big corporations as well. And that explains where the experiments came from. It's just a bunch of like rich yeah. assholes mm-hmm. having their little experiments. Like, I think one said, what if we put the kids and the parents not together in the vaults and like the strongest kids will survive and all that. And it just makes more sense now knowing that. Like, so it wasn't Vault-Tec that did that. It was these like rich, like arseholes playing God.
Yeah, a huge conglomerate of various different corporations, wasn't it? Yeah, I'm fully on board with what they did with the flashback scenes, because it's always been like, there's always been sort of touches of it, little bits of flavor of it throughout the games, but we've never really seen much of it. You know, in the games, what's the pre-war stuff we've seen? That one bit at the beginning of Fallout 4. But having all your corporations kind of finally come together when they're told by, you know, when Vault-Tec sort of says, hey, let's all work together and commit crimes against humanity, you know, and keep our profit margin going. And Cooper's kind of development, his arc going from, you know, well, early on when you see him and they've changed the script, so he shoots the guy in the face and he's like, hey, I'm not the guy who does that. I'm the guy who, I arrest people, you know, I'm an American. We do good. We American, we do good thing, you know. To put it one way, but learning that, you know, and at points he does talk about how, no, America's the greatest country in the world. We've got freedom. We've got capitalism, you know.
Because he fought in the war, didn't he? Like,
yes, he did. He fought in the Battle of Anchorage. Yeah, that's right. Which is revealed later on when he's talking about the T-45 armor.
Yeah.
And a good bit of DLC for Fallout 3, that.
It is great.
Yeah, really hard, though. So, you know, he talks about fighting the communists and how awful they are. And talks about, you know, communism ends with breadlines. But over time, he realizes that actually capitalism just ends up with, you know, three really rich guys at the top stomping all over everyone else. So, like, which is the right way to go. Maybe one, maybe the other, maybe neither. Maybe bomb everyone and just let the world kind of decide, you know? And by the end of it, that's kind of how he comes across when he's a ghoul. He's like, he didn't have any reason to care. He's seen 200 years of humanity just tearing itself apart. Yeah. You know, he's gone from the ultimate idealist to the ultimate cynic. But then by the end, he's got a little bit of that, not idealism back, but a little bit more reason, having stumbled upon, you know, the overseer whose name I've suddenly forgotten. What's his name again?
McLean.
Is it Hank?
Hank McLean, yeah.
Hank McLean, that's
right. With the ghoul, you kind of see aspects of his humanity in earlier episodes as well, because I think he has, does he have Lucy as a prisoner at this point? I don't know, but then they see this ghoul who's going feral, and he crazy. Puts him down, but he just before he does it, he says, oh, remember the apple pie or something?
Apple pie.
Yeah. And it gives him a good memory, then he puts him out of his misery.
Yeah, his last memory is, that's it. He turns to Lucy, doesn't he? And he's smiling, talking about this apple pie. And it's and he shoots him so that he doesn't even know he's going to get shot either, because he can't see the gun, which was very sort of Mice and Men. Hey, Lenny or George, look at the rabbits.
Yeah.
You know, sure. type of situation.
Think of the apple pie.
Yeah, a nice mercy kill. That does bring me to a point, actually. That I wanted to bring up, and this was one note I had on something I wasn't sure I liked, was that now I think this is a new bit of lore or a bit of a retcon. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems to this chem that he keeps taking through his little inhaler is implied to be stopping him from going feral. Now the series seems to imply that going feral is now an inevitability without that drug. I don't think that's ever been a thing in the past. I'm pretty sure that while the majority of ghouls did turn feral, the ones who didn't, you know, the ones who you're coming across in the games are fine. You know, they're ghouls. They've got, you know, they're kind of like living zombies, but they, you know, they live within society and aren't inherently a threat. And now turning them all into ticking time bombs, I don't think works quite so well, because that gives kind of, you know, the Brotherhood of Steel, they hate ghouls, they kill every ghoul on sight. And that was always like, that's because they're essentially racists. You know, they are human supremacists. Ghouls are an abomination. Even if they're not feral, we kill them, despite the fact that they don't deserve that. But now every ghoul, as I say, being a ticking time bomb, it gives the Brotherhood more justification for that. And I don't think that works as well. I think it's nicer to have ghouls that can just live and not have to constantly be worried about eventually turning on everyone. I don't think that is a good change. Whether we examine it more, we don't know. You know, presumably the ghoul is going to have access to that drug for as long as he needs to, really. Yeah. And
he got a giant supply, didn't he?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I'd hope that any other ghouls we're going to see on the regular are also going to have plenty of that, so we don't have to just see them all eventually turn feral, because that's not something we need. Ghouls are a good thing to have around. You know, I like ghouls. I think they've always got a lot of really good personality, and I don't need to see them all eventually turn into zombies.
How did you feel about how the series handled the creatures? Because we don't get a lot, but we do get some. I was a little bit sad we didn't get any Deathclaws, but yeah, how did you think, one, the CGI looked, and two, how it handled the inclusion of these creatures? Si, what do you think?
Oh, I mean, when it comes to the Deathclaw, it's one of those things that you want to hold back on, right?
Yeah.
I think don't they show a skull? You see a skull
right at the end.
Yeah,
right
at the end. See, look, at least I recognize this kind of thing, right? But that seems like something that's like, oh, I'm going to make you wait for that, and it's fair. For me, there probably could have been a bit more of it, ideally, but I also understand, you know, budgetary reasons, CGI reasons, can be a little bit hokey. What they did do largely, I thought, was quite good. Like, because it has, I wouldn't say a colorful palette, but it's certainly not a dark show by any means. Mm. Like, the fact that the CGI might not always be perfect, it just kind of worked for me. Like, we've got a bit of slapstick humor. The guy gets mauled to death by this giant bear thing. It's kind of fun and goofy. It might not look perfect all the time, but I was engaged enough with the way that it set up the universe. It didn't matter too much.
Yeah.
I like the way they used the rad roaches was cool. And so overall, for me, was fine. The swamp thing probably looked the worst, but it It's fine.
Is that a gulper?
I think they called it a gulper. Called? And yeah,
right.
I don't.
It's a new thing, right?
It's got like loads of human fingers in its mouth.
It has, hasn't
and
it?
And then
yeah.
you kind of learn potentially why, because in Vault 4, they're doing experiments.
Yeah, that was the origin.
Like, gives birth, and I guess that's why it has fingers.
Gives birth to piranhas that then eat her. Which, that's okay. Brutal. That was nice. I think the gulper, I think at times it maybe looked a little bit janky again, which is, it tends to be a problem when you have something with TV budget that tries to illuminate its CGI characters in bright daylight.
You
know, the trick is hide them in shadow. You know, the season one of The Witcher was extremely guilty of not having a big budget for its CGI and trying to show it all on screen at once. And that gold dragon looked awful. If they had just hidden it in shadow, would look great. But I don't think it matters so much with, say, the gulper, because I just think its design was so imaginative. You know, I was not focused on, oh, this looks a little bit off. I was focused on, oh, it's got human fingers inside of its mouth instead of teeth, and that's a really...
It's kind of cartoony looking, isn't
yeah,
it?
Like, gross by design? Bit of design. Like, yeah, an excellent imaginative bit of design, which I think kind of transcends any flaws that some of the CGI might have. And with the other creatures, you know, we had the bear, the Yaogi.
Yaogi.
Yaogi. Are they called that because it sounds like yogi?
That's my thinking as well. Yaogi bear.
I think it is. I think it's a reference to some Chinese creature, isn't it? Which right. kind of makes a lot of sense with China having a lot to do with the background of Fallout. But we had the Yaogi, which was good. I think, you know, a creature like that is a good threat, and it is the sort of thing which realistically could kill a guy in grey big armor.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of rad roaches, and that makes a lot of sense because they're the sort of things that would be extremely common. Yeah. You know, they're all of the wildlife you're gonna see. And there wasn't a great deal of other stuff, was there? We didn't get mole rats.
We didn't get
rad scorpions. We didn't get this, that, the other. And super mutants, of course, we didn't get.
Yeah.
And there were several different points where I thought, oh, they're teasing a super mutant here. We're going to get a super mutant. And that didn't happen. And sometimes I would be a little bit like, oh, I really want a super mutant. But actually, let's get to season two or season three and have the super mutants be a big deal instead of just like random guys that the protagonists encounter sometimes and fight. Because you have to adapt this world, don't you? It can't, you know, I can imagine there being a lot of complaints from people going, well, there's not enough combat, you know, when you play the games, there's constantly, you know, there's so many more enemies and things, but then your show wouldn't have a story.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would just be a series of CGI fight scenes.
Yeah,
which
it would be a video game cutscene, really.
Yeah, and I could understand why that would appeal to some of the fans, because you get to see a bunch of creatures that they know and love and point and whatever, but I don't think it would land in a way that would make it memorable.
No.
It would be just like, yeah, as you say, a cool cut scene, essentially, that's part live action, whereas for this to succeed with a wider audience and also just to have a lasting impact, the most important thing is the fact that it told a bunch of different stories, both post and pre-war as well, set up a bunch of characters and a bunch of stuff for season two. So I think they made the right choice there. I think you're right. There'll probably be more in future seasons now that we're off the ground. But this is more just like laying things down to move forward. You talked about some stuff that you didn't like, Joe, throughout that. Dan, is there anything in the season that you didn't particularly take to or you thought could have been done better?
So I did have a couple of gripes with it. And I did message you about this earlier on, Si. So with Vault 32... I don't think it ever explained how they all died, because it's implied that there's a load of violence that's happened. You've got people sticking knives in toasters and like taking their own lives and things like that. But like, it's never fully explained like why. So obviously they found out what was going on, but they kind of just left it at that, I think. And I was a little bit confused about that. I didn't like how we saw a couple of like plasma pistols and laser rifles and things like that, and they never got fired once. Did you notice that? It was all like ballistic weapons.
Good point. Good point. Yeah, they didn't do much with energy weapons or anything, did they?
Yeah.
They did have a junk jet early on.
Yeah, I know, that was so cool.
The guy gets killed with a baby doll's leg.
And there was the thing about, is it Moldova? Moldova?
Moldova, yeah.
Moldova.
Yeah.
So it's not explained how she is... She's a little bit older, but like how she got from being the same age pre-war to still being alive. Like, obviously she's like froze herself or something in one of those cryo chambers, but it's never explained how she got from hating Vault-Tec and all that to then getting in the vault,
into one of those chambers,
Yeah, it's kind of just glossed over. I guess we've got to like make that assumption ourselves. And in the final episode, with the Brotherhood of Steel, when they're at the Griffiths Observatory. when Cooper shows up, he somehow knows the weakness in the power armor. But when he fights him earlier in the series, like Maximus, he doesn't mention that.
Oh, yeah, he wasn't.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah,
wasn't considering that at all, was he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that feels like a kind of intentional oversight to just to raise the stakes earlier on, but then to allow him to just be a complete invincible sort of badass later, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose that's maybe that's a little bit weak, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But other than that, like, a lot of them are just nitpicks.
Yeah, I think like I think your thing about the ghoul, because he's credited as Cooper in the flashbacks, and he's credited as the ghoul later on. So, you know, the ghoul, kind of the ghoul, because he's the man with no name, I suppose. The idea that he seems to conveniently remember later on that the armor has a weakness, that's not great. I think your questions with Moldova and the vault dwellers, I suppose I would say with Moldova, I guess we can just assume that she somehow contrived a way to get into that cryopod. You know, she's clearly got like a lot of power in some way.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll find out there was another sort of insider, you know, who was going to take things down 200 years later. I don't know. What I gleaned from Vault 32, and I suppose this is just me making up in my head, some of those characters had committed suicide and some of them had killed each other. Presumably, you know, you've got the knife in the toaster person in front of the telly who couldn't deal with it all. The overseer, however, has been clearly tied up and murdered. And I'm guessing it's a bit of a kind of Vault 33 situation where there were certain people who were from Vault 31 originally who were trying to kind of keep the status quo, and various Vault 32 inhabitants found out, and it created a kind of civil war within the Vault. That civil war then having kind of taken over any of the farming or anything, so all the crops died and any last survivors just died off.
Died. Mm-hmm.
But that's
it would have
me.
Been really good if they'd have made that clear, I think. Like, I would have been all about that. But yeah, the fact they left it really vague about what happened is also something that I came out of the show like, oh, kind of feel like I got a half-finished story when it came to the sort of trilogy of Vaults Connected, which I thought was a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
Obviously brand new for the franchise. But some of those questions feel like they're left hanging for a season two.
Yeah, because we're clearly going to get those characters again for season
right.
two.
The vaults are going to be a major part. Those three vaults are going to continue to be a major part of it. Which I don't know if you can necessarily say the same thing with Lee Moldaver, who's presumably dead.
Yeah,
we
reckon she's dead.
Which leaves all these questions unexplained unless she comes back or is still a major part of the story drive despite not being alive anymore for season two. Yeah, how she's still around for 200 years. Is she a synth? I've seen people suggesting that.
Oh, okay.
It's a little odd that they made a big reveal of her, like pre-war her, meeting Cooper, but then they don't really explain how we get from point A to point B. So yeah. For me, that's a big thing that I was like, oh, that's kind of trailed off at the end there.
Yeah, maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't. Before we do go on to talking about any season two stuff, I've just, you know, speaking of the vaults, I wasn't expecting to get so much back in Vault 33. I thought it was really nice that actually got its own full story, centering around Norm,
the brother. Yeah,
you know, because he in that early montage, you know, and Lucy's talking about how great she is and how sunshine's out of her ass. Norm is like sat there on his Pip-Boy playing like one of the little kind of Game and Watch style games, like the missile defense game or whatever it was.
Missile Command.
Yeah. And
he
seems completely ineffectual and kind of useless. But then he actually starts doing a bit of detective work, and gets very much his own story. And I love that they paired him up with Chet. You know, your big sort of Lucy's big tall cousin who's in love with her. A bit weird. Yeah, they talked about cousin stuff, didn't they? And it's like, okay, Shelbyville. But I did find it just a really charming kind of visual gag that they were essentially doing, that Norm is this comically short little guy and Chet is extremely tall, and they're both good, you know. They have to frame it all really awkwardly so that they're both in frame.
Yeah.
I swear Chet is like 2 foot taller than Norm. But I thought their characterization was great, and all the stuff that was going on in the vault with the kind of the sort of political struggle between these kind of oblivious, nice guy counselors and then and then Betty, who was, you know, basically angling to become a dictator. Very, very nice bit of subplot going on there.
Yeah.
And it'll be good to see kind of where that goes later, whether these characters also have to leave the vault.
Also, Norm hacked her terminal in one try as well.
Yeah.
When you do that in the game, it's the best feeling.
Yeah. That seemed very lucky, didn't it? He could have at least got it wrong once.
Uh-huh. What did you think of the whole Shady Sands thing? The whole
reveal? I was going to ask that next.
They dropped the bomb on that, because that was the big twist.
There's been some contention there, hasn't there? I think, like, I've seen some of the usual kind of internet outrage on, it's not been dreadful, but there's been people saying, oh, that's kind of disrespectful to Fallout 70, not Fallout 76 fans. They don't deserve respect. I kid, if you like Fallout 76, great. I'm sure it's fine.
I went back to try that again, actually, recently.
Was it any good?
No. Like it. So fine. You can't do missions in co-op, so like that the story progresses for both players who are playing together, which
that's
is
rubbish.
Sucky. So I just
that's completely
it.
Stupid. yes, not Fallout 76, Fallout New Vegas. People said Fallout New Vegas fans have been disrespected because this makes Fallout New Vegas non-canon. And the implication is because Shady Sands was bombed in 2277. Which I think is the year that Fallout 3 is set. And of course, Fallout New Vegas takes place in 2281. So this taking place in 2294 or 20,
something like that.
2290 something, isn't it?
Anyway,
that it matters. You know, so this is sometime after those bombs have dropped, but also sometime after Fallout New Vegas could have happened. But I don't necessarily agree that it makes it non-canon. I think it maybe changes a few things, but New Vegas is clearly still there. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously planning to do something really important with New Vegas. Like if you were if you were trying to like do some disrespectful New Vegas is non-canon, why would you tease New Vegas
at the end?
And why would you have Robert House show up in that board meeting?
So cool.
You know, Mr. Robco himself, Robert House, the best name in Fallout, because it sounds made up.
It was in the quiz that, remember?
Yeah, Robert House. Uh-huh.
The Fallout quiz available now on More Culture Gaming YouTube.
That's it, yeah.
You'll never guess who won.
They showed the NCR flag. It played the main Fallout theme over it.
Yeah.
And it kind of set the NCR up as the traditional good guys, the good faction.
Yeah. I think the NCR is kind of always, it's always been the closest Fallout's had to a kind of decent faction. Because, I mean, the NCR is what Lee Moldaver and Lucy's mum, Rose, you know, they were part of that and it did come across as a good place.
But at the start, you had them going into Vault 33 and just murdering everyone, like with the raiders.
Yeah, I would imagine that they're no longer the NCR anymore, are they, by that point? You know, the NCR were a nice faction. They were peaceful. They were kind of democratic. And then they get nuked by this overseer because their world does not fit his narrow vision of a utopia. So he nukes them or he bombs them or whatever. I think you probably would abandon your nice, peaceful principles and, you know, you would kill, you know, you just fight your way through who you need to fight in order to get this guy. And the fact that those raiders didn't murder every single person in that vault, which was what I was fully expecting. No, you know, they came in to get Hank, and that's what they did. They pretty much left once they had that opportunity, rather than just outright murdering everyone like a gang of raiders would do. So I don't think it contradicts it, in my own opinion anyway.
I think, as you guys have said, the fact they've hinted towards New Vegas is handy because, if nothing else, this being a big talking point among the fans now, they're probably going to double down on that in Season 2 to try and, if you want to call it correct their mistake or whatever, but just reassure fans that, no, we're trying to do right by everyone. I know the writer came out on Twitter to say that, nope, New Vegas is definitely still canon. I've been very careful about making sure the lore is handled well. Whether there was like a mistake in the dates or whatever, or there's more to this that we don't know, that is definitely something that I think will become clearer in a Season 2. Whether it was intended to or not before, I think they're going to respond to that because there are been a lot of upset fans about it, which is fair enough, I guess. But let's talk about Season 2 then.
Yeah.
Do you want to see more New Vegas stuff? Where do you want to see these characters go? What do you expect from it? We've talked about plot threads that are left hanging that may or may not be picked back up on. But Dan, what would you like to see out of a Season 2?
I want to see Lucy continue to grow and like level up and become more of a badass, get some cool gear, I think. Like, that would be cool. I want to see like more mutated creatures and more of this world. Trying to think. It'd be nice to see the Mysterious Stranger as well. I thought we may potentially get a hint at that with his little theme tune, but we didn't, so that's yet to come. And I think like seeing Vats in live action as well, if they could figure out a way to introduce that into the series, I think would be cool. And I just want them to continue the path that they're going on, because they clearly know what they're doing with this like source material, and like I fully trust them after this first season because I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, Vats was one of the major things for me that was like noticeably missing, and for good reason, because it's a gameplay thing more than anything else. So, but it would be interesting for them to, even if they just sort of like winked and nod about it a little bit, and kind of mentioned it rather than made it a part of the actual show. But in terms of character arcs, we've got Maximus at the end there actually being knighted as Knight Maximus, presumably. I would like to see his character, now that he's seen the vault and kind of connected with people outside of his faction, how he might necessarily push back against the Brotherhood of Steel's ways and sort of become at odds with his upbringing and that kind of stuff and the people that he works with alongside there, because he's had an interesting sort of perspective on it now going through what he did in the first season. So I'm really interested actually to see where his character goes. We know what the Gauler's doing. I'm kind of left at a loss for what's next for Lucy, really, other than chasing down her dad, which is the plot of season one.
Mm-hmm. More side quests,
now,
I guess.
But now he's evil. Yeah, yeah. We're going to do more BS, as the Gaul calls it, which was a fantastic line, by the way, that we need to mention. Joe, what do you think from a season two? What would you like to see?
So, I suppose for me, the Maximus stuff is going to be very interesting because the last thing we see of him really is, you know, Lucy tries desperately to get him to wake up and then leaves him, I guess, presuming he might be dead. So the last thing he finds is he wakes up and he's been abandoned by them. And then the Brotherhood all rallies round him based on a lie.
That's true.
I do wonder, is he going to feel betrayed? Is he now leading a Brotherhood that he doesn't really want to be a part of, but he's also been, quote unquote, abandoned by his friends? So I think there's some interesting potential for some good character interplay there. As for the other characters, I think you two both explained kind of where we think they're going to go. Season two, yeah, great. I'd like to see some New Vegas. I'd like to see some of that. But honestly, what I will say now is, I'd rather talk about what I want to see for season three.
Go on.
Interesting.
because season two is obviously going to continue this story. I had actually been hoping that at the end of season one, their stories would conclude. Because I think Fallout should be an anthology. I think if you have season two, let them finish their stories there rather than do a Walking Dead thing where it eventually just circles the drain until everyone gets bored of it, you know, and falls off. I would say their stories, let that play out, so they have, you know, they have like a 16 episode run or something if they're going to do another 8-part.
Yeah,
that's nice. Their stories are then done, so we've had our vault dweller, we've had our like ghoul gunslinger, we've had our Brotherhood of Steel initiate type character. Turn it into an anthology after that. You know, those characters are done. Maybe they'll turn up. Maybe they'll turn up in a scene or something. But then let's have season three be set, maybe not in New Vegas this time, because we presumably will have done that, but set it in, I don't know, Atlantic City, you know, and have it
you
be
saw
like
the map
a,
of the vaults. Like, there's so many vaults around the United States.
Yeah.
Set it in Vault 69.
You know. let's get Vault 69 in there. Really nice. You know, but let's go to Atlantic City and do a season that's just like a gangster type thing, you know, where we've got kind of, you know, we've got everyone in kind of sharp suits doing organized crime and bootlegging and what have you. You know, let's do another season that's set like right kind of out in the Midwest in a much more sparse area that's more purely like a Western. You know, let's do another season that's set in another city that's a film noir, you know, a Nick Valentine style detective thing. I think like they could really just lean into the various genres that Fallout is clearly inspired by without having to always be about the same characters, because the best thing about adapting Fallout, and this is where I'll say that, you know, there's been the argument of, is this the best video game adaptation, or is The Last of Us the best video game adaptation? They're both wrong. Season one of Castlevania is the best video game adaptation.
Nice.
But but for me, this one works better, because I saw The Last of Us season one in 2013, and it was called The Last of Us, and it was a PS3 game, you know? It was good. It's great. It's really nice that like non-gamers get to you know, appreciate that story. But the best bits of The Last of Us on TV were where it deviated. And
right.
Fallout is a story
kind of all
about
deviation.
Story is all about story. Fallout is all about deviation. Fallout is a story of its world.
Yeah.
And to only explore that world through the lens of three specific characters is a huge misstep. You've got the whole of America there. You've got like all of kind of this very specific kind of facet of American culture and beyond that you can explore. And I think that's what we need. Like, let's give Lucy and Maximus and Cooper, to give him his real name, let's give them their a satisfying conclusion and let them go on with whatever they're doing. Their story continues, and then we jet off somewhere else, and then somewhere else, and Fallout continues to evolve and expand and just have fun with its world rather than shackle itself to its protagonists.
Big time, actually. Yeah, I think that what's interesting about the two shows as a comparison, as they are being compared right now, The Last of Us, now we're moving into season two. We're moving into rocky territory, of course. You know, people are going to have all kinds of different reactions to that. And then potentially moving onwards beyond that point, who even really knows? But with Fallout, it seems like the future is potentially brighter because there's so much they could possibly do with it, because they're not adapting just a straight-up video game plot. They are just using that world as a vehicle to tell stories. And I'm actually all about the anthology thing. I hadn't even thought about that before, but it's a great way to do it. Even if it wasn't necessarily as cut and dry as two seasons for these characters and then we move on to the next, we kind of have them go a little bit longer, but we've introduced to another character and then someone drops off and we make more room for somebody else and kind of moving across the map that way. Because I think if you go kind of cut and went, right, we're on to a new set of characters, people might disengage from it and be like, oh, I cared about these guys. But that way, you're kind of like, oh, we're metering it out from next bit to next bit and kind of transforming it. And it gives the show longer legs like that. Because I do think that, and I've always thought this with Fallout, even as someone that hasn't played the games, the world is so interesting. There's so much you could do with it. So the show has the potential to do so much if it continues to be as well received as it has been so far.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. And I understand the, taking an abrupt pivot from Lucy Maximus and the ghoul might come across as very odd. But yeah, like a gradual shift, but still a marked shift to other genres and places, I think would be, let them feed into one another, maybe, is a good way to do it.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, I guess that'll do it for our breakdown of season one of the Fallout TV series. You can follow us all on social media, which is probably up on the screen now if you're watching the video version. I don't know how to do an outro, clearly. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for having us, Si.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
I've been Si. Thank you for watching / listening. This has gone off the rails really quickly. And we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.